When I was first diagnosed, I was told that chances are this wouldn't happen again, so I didn't really worry about it. But a year later, I proved them wrong.
This is TBI, Talking Brain Injury, from Brain Injury Alliance Colorado. I'm your host, Phil, a four-time recipient of brain injuries I don't even remember, plus all the ones I kind of maybe do remember. In this episode, I talk with Deb Brandon. She is a survivor of the bloody brain.
And that's when I had acute bleeds. It wasn't just this oozing thing. And all hell broke loose.
Deb has lived with cavernous angioma since 2007. She's a published writer and nicknamed her tangled blood vessels the bloody brain. But she doesn't think of her condition as an evil nemesis, more of a grumpy companion.
It made me put words into what was going on with me. And I found once I had a word for it, for instance, sensory overload, I stopped thinking that I was insane.
I talk with Deb about life before and after her TBI and how finding those right words to describe her experience led to understanding, to healing, and a memoir. It's titled, But My Brain Had Other Ideas. The Pikes Peak Challenge, it's almost here. It is the biggest fundraiser of the year for Brain Injury Alliance Colorado. Hundreds of survivors, friends, family, and volunteers will gather in Manitou Springs for a low-key fun run, a 13-mile hiking loop, or the big show, a summit of Pikes Peak at 14,115 feet. Join me on the trail to Pikes Peak, or support the cause right now by donating to my team, Team TBI Podcast, at pikespeakchallenge.com. All your donations go right back to the Brain Injury Alliance. I'll see you out there September 7th. Hey everyone, it's Phil Lindemann with the BIAC podcast, TBI Talking Brain Injury from Brain Injury Alliance, Colorado. And today I'm joined on Zoom by Deb Brandon. She's out in Boulder. Deb, thanks for making some time.
Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy these kind of things.
But you've done some podcasting before? Do you got your own podcast or have you just been a guest before?
I've been a guest before.
Where can other people find your voice right now? What other podcasts?
There's Blog Talk Radio. It's the actual show is called Another Fork in the Road. I've done a lot of, oh no, that's a radio show. So that most of them are sort of author related, though some are brain injury related. So I don't, you know what? I don't remember.
but you're,
I have an excuse. I mean, if you look at my website, you can see all the stuff most of the stuff I've done.
What's the website?
DebBrandon.com. So it's two B's, DebBrandon.
Your brain injury, what was it? What did you encounter and when did it first hit?
Okay, when I was 46 years old, so that's, where are we, 2006, I had these fleeting symptoms, one of my hands, neuropathy, dizziness, vertigo. And I, at the time, I was going through some very stressful stuff. So I thought, oh, well, it's manifestation of stress. And it really lasted no more than a day. And I didn't think much of it. I thought, yeah, this is stress, no big deal. But next time I went to my PCP for a checkup, I told her about it. And she sent me for, an EKG and brain MRI. And that's how I was diagnosed with cavernous angiomas, which are clusters of malformed blood vessels, and they're thin walled and they can bleed. Now, the it's not like an aneurysm that gushes. It's fairly slow. In most cases, it just oozes blood, but even that can cause a lot of problems. And in my case, two of mine bled. When I was first diagnosed, I was told that chances are this wouldn't happen again. So I didn't really worry about it. But a year later, I proved them wrong. And that's when I had acute bleeds. It wasn't just this oozing thing. And all hell broke loose. So then, seizures, of course, horrific headaches. It was really bad. I couldn't drive. I couldn't work. And I finally, and I was very much in denial about cavernous angiomas. I didn't want to know about them because I, somewhere in my brain, I managed to convince myself that if I don't learn about them, somehow they'll disappear. but things got so bad to the point where, well, and it wasn't just so bad because of this, my situation. It got really bad psychologically when I went into hospital for because of seizures. I went into the ER, and they did an EK, no, an EEG on me, and nothing showed up. And as I'm sure many of the people who listen to this podcast know, that when it comes to seizures, they don't always show up as epileptic, and not all seizures are epileptic. And she decided, without further, she didn't look into it any further. She decided that was a nutcase, because she said that these are based on her one EEG. She decided that I was, where are we? I can do this. She decided that they were psychogenic, basically they're due to stress. And she said, "Are you stressed out?" And I said, "Well, I've got this stuff going on in my brain. Yes, I'm stressed out." And she said, "Well, they're perfectly harmless." And I said, "Well, if they're harmless, why is it that I can't walk without toppling over?" And she said, "You're having trouble with your balance?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Show me." And she wanted me to keep going, even though I couldn't even do two steps heel to toe. She wanted me to go heel to toe. And I started flailing, and she said, "No, keep going." And I fell and caught myself. I fell towards the bed and caught myself. And she said, "You don't have problems with your balance. I forget the word she said, but basically she was telling me that I was faking it for attention. I need therapy." So, which was quite lovely. But unfortunately, when it comes to brain injury, you've got enough self-doubt and stuff like that going on. And now there was this thing in my brain. It started this thing with, well, maybe I am being melodramatic. Maybe if I tried harder, I'd have no trouble with my balance. And maybe if I, all this kind of stuff. And that stuck with me. To a lesser extent now, but for the longest time, I was constantly questioning my what was happening. Is this headache really bad, or is it just your imagination? This kind of stuff. It goes nuts, So that really set me off. Set me spiraling into depression.
This particular doc didn't utter that awful phrase, "It's all in your head," did she?
Yes, she did. And she didn't even use the term she said psychogenic, and then she said, she used a word which is really horrible. It's, I forget what it was, but it was something along the lines of pseudo seizures. That's what it's something like that. I forget what it was. But basically, she said, "I need to go see a therapist." And this was all before she'd even looked at my file. And I told her that I have cavernous angiomas, and she goes off again and comes back and said, "Yes, you do have cavernous angiomas, but they're completely harmless." So, I know I'm not the only one who's gone through something similar. It's pretty an awful thing to go through, especially while you're going through something really horrendous. But on the other hand, this is what, she basically yanked me out of denial. And I started looking into what can be done. And I'm thinking in terms of, I don't think I can keep living like this. And that was my first bout of suicide ideation. I just, I said, "I can't do this." And I started researching and looking for options. And I learned that the only known treatment for to prevent future bleeds is to remove the bleeders surgically. So I underwent two brain injuries to remove the two bleeders that I had. And then I ended up, a week later, I ended up needing an emergency surgery because I had a cerebral spinal fluid leak from the site of one of the surgeries. So all in all, within 3 weeks, I underwent three brain surgeries.
Did you ever second guess your decision that maybe I shouldn't have done
surgery?
The surgeries?
No.
Yeah, no, it was always,
no.
This
I
is
mean,
the right
to me,
thing.
This was my only chance to reclaim my life. And, you know, I had two teenagers at the time. It wasn't an option for me. For me, it wasn't much of a choice there. If I wanted a chance at living as quote unquote normal life, I was going to take it at that point.
A difficult decision for sure. I mean, like, just especially after running into, well, one doctor that says it's all in your head, and you say, of course it's in my head. I've got these angiomas that are in my head.
I still refer to her as the evil neurologist. I mean, and yet I wanted to send a letter to her or her employer, but my then husband said, no, you don't want to do that because, and at the time I wasn't, you know, in terms of confusion and stuff like that, I was not exactly thinking straight. And I certainly didn't have the energy to argue. So I didn't do anything about it. But three, four, 5 years later, I wrote her a letter and had it and posted it as a blog post. You know, Dear Dr. S. And it felt better. And I thought, well, maybe one day I'll send it, you know, but I don't know if I will. my concern was that she would do this to someone else.
Yes.
And I'm sure she did, quite frankly, because she was an awful woman, put it that way.
The evil neurologist, that's a good title for your next book, your fiction book that comes after this one.
Well, I at one point, okay, so this is a non sequitur. My mother had a, my mother grew up in England, and she had a teacher in school who was a missionary, and she went to Africa and got eaten by cannibals. And I was telling my writing coach about it, and she said, it's a great title for a murder mystery. So I could have something along the lines of the evil neurologist and the cannibals, you know that.
I'd read it. I'd absolutely read it. It's like some Dr. Moreau stuff, you know.
Well, I had this idea that I'd put in recipes, you know, of each chapter would start with a little recipe.
Hey, you should hook up with, I'm forgetting her name right now, but another guest that I've had on the podcast. She is also in the midst of writing a book, a fantasy novel that also has very dark recipes in it. And when she was telling me about her idea of having these, you know, witchy recipes mixed in with some fantastical stuff, I was thinking, oh, I want to read that book now. And please make these recipes something I can, well, you know, duplicate, like, you know, the kids at Halloween time with worms in the mud instead of, you know, actual real worms in blood or whatever she was going for.
Yeah, no, I wasn't doing worms. I was doing bits of people because we're talking about cannibals, right? So.
And I'm looking at your book right now. Tell me how you became an author. Were you an author before writing this book, but my brain had other ideas?
No, I mean, I hadn't written since high school, basically. Until the pandemic started, I was a math professor at Carnegie Mellon University. But after my brain injury, I wanted to understand. So this happened in 2007, and I wanted to understand more about my situation. And I also wanted to understand the enormity of what happened to me. So I started writing, and it was a journal type thing. But as I wrote, I realized that I wanted it originally for my family or friends to read, to get an idea of the impact of my brain injury. And then I realized that there are a lot of people that need this kind of thing. So I figured out that I wanted to reach a broader audience. So I started working with a writing coach because people kept telling me, oh, your writing's great, but I knew it wasn't that good. I mean, it was okay. It was decent, but not decent enough to publish, in my mind at least. Well, in her mind too. But she transformed me from a journal writer to, well, as you know, an award-winning book. And then when it comes to the journey to publishing, I got an agent, which is considered the big deal amongst people who are trying to publish. Mm-hmm. And it was she was a big deal agent, but you know, she'd peddled celebrity memoirs before, including Obama and I forget who else. So for some reason, she decided this is how she's going to try and sell my memoir, which as a celebrity memoir, and it didn't work. I'm not surprised because I'm not a celebrity. But so at that point, I had two choices: to keep pursuing the traditional publishing way, but it was painful doing it. It's you submit to umpteen agents and publishers, and it's not easy to break in. So I just, at one point, I just told my writing coach that I just want to go with hybrid publishing. I wanted something that would, the trouble with self-publishing is that a lot of people self-publish and it doesn't go through any filter in terms of, well, editing may not be great, whatever. And I like the idea of hybrid publishing because they do take you through that process. I got, you know, editors, copy editors, and all that kind of stuff. And you don't, and you send them a book proposal and they'll tell you if they'll take you on or not. So, the two problems. One is that with hybrid, like self-publishing, with hybrid publishing, you pay for it to be published. But on the other hand, they have the capability for marketing it more than you can distribution. And you don't have to look into the nitty-gritty because I knew that I wouldn't be able to do it. In terms of self-publishing, but you pay for it. On the other hand, with traditional publishing, the royalties are pretty pathetic. And unless, again, you're a celebrity author. So what happened was, so if you go hybrid, you get a bigger chunk of the royalties. I mean, if you're lucky with traditional publishing, you get 20%, and that's usually not the case. It's usually less. With hybrid publishing, I think I have 80% royalties, which is a huge difference. Not that I'm saying that you can earn a living like this. I mean, unless you're in the right place at the right time and you've produced something like J.K. Rowling did, chances are you're not going to earn a living as a writer. Most authors, you know, people who aren't celebrities, most authors, or, well, who aren't well known or whatnot, they just, lost my train of thought. Well, let's see.
Well, like you were saying, it's just, It's a tough industry to break into, and you had to find the one that worked best for you. And so that hybrid mix was, well, it seemed like a good way to make it happen. Although it does come with the barrier of you got to pay for it still. So, I mean.
Yeah, and that's not little. And then the other thing that you have to do once it's published, well, actually before it's published, before the publication date comes, you have to start marketing it and publicizing it. And actually, with both traditional and hybrid and self-publishing, you have to market it. It used to be that traditional publishers would do a lot of that for you. Now they really don't. So, which means having a, you know, having messing around with social media, giving a lot of talks, all that kind of thing. But, you know, if you can, it's well worth it. It opens up a whole new world. Joining the writing world was, well, and being a writer, it completely enriched my life, and it really helped me through the recovery process. It helped me understand because, you know, it made me put words into what was going on with me. And I found once I had a word for it, for instance, sensory overload, I stopped thinking that I was insane. And once I had a word, I knew how to try and avoid it or make it, you know, lessen the intensity. Another word was, what was it? Oh, task initiation. Until I had a word for it, and even a little bit after that, I thought that was all about laziness or procrastination. That's the word. So you feel inadequate that you're not dealing with life appropriately. So once I understood what it was and that it was a bona fide symptom of a brain injury, it really helped. Not completely, but to quite an extent, a significant extent.
Has that inspired you to continue on writing? Do you have any other, you know, manuscripts?
Oh, absolutely. I became really passionate about writing. And as I said, it's really enriched my life. In fact, I consider that one of the gains from Bloody Brain. And I refer to it as the Bloody Brain because it literally bled. And the other one is, I'm English. I get to say stuff like that. No one judges you. If you explain that you're English, unless they notice my accent.
I hope you're enjoying my talk with Deb Brandon. I know that I had a blast talking with her about memoir and The Bloody Brain. Her sense of humor, it still gets me to this day. Coming up soon on September 7th, the Pikes Peak Challenge, the biggest fundraiser of the year for Brain Injury Alliance Colorado. And for the first time ever, I will be out on the trail, hiking all the way up to 14,115 feet. You can donate right now to the cause. All money goes back to BIAC by supporting my team. That's TBI Podcast, Team TBI Podcast. Find us right now and donate whatever you have. I will be very, very grateful. Team TBI Podcast, that's on PikesPeakChallenge.com. I'll even give you a shout out right here on the podcast after the hike. Well, in some ways, I mean, it sort of is a horror story, especially when folks are reading, you know, just even the beginning of it. You bring us into the confusion, the horror of being stuck in the moment of brain bleeds.
It's funny because I don't think about it as horror. Because I don't regret that it happened. I wouldn't want to repeat the experience, but I'm glad it actually happened because it brought me to a place that, you know, I'm a happier person. I'm certainly a better person. That, you know, I know that happens a lot, but, for the longest time, I thought of the Bloody Brain as a malevolent entity that has taken over my body or whatnot, something that I was possessed by an evil entity. But now it's more like I see it more as a grumpy companion. But it really got me writing. that I would never have done before, you know, otherwise. I improved very much. My teaching skills improved very much. And then there's all the other stuff that comes from the actual, I mean, for instance, having to ask for help. I was very much think socially awkward mathematician. I was very much that person. And I had to ask for help. I had no choice. But when you ask for help, you're placing your trust in someone, and many people reciprocate that. So I learned, and I became more interested in people, and I, from a painfully shy introvert, I transformed into I refer to myself as an eager extrovert, because I became actively interested in people. I want to hear their stories. And of course, like many other brain injury survivors, I want people to hear my story, not just about the brain injury, but about me as a person. So it really brought me to a really good place. And things like sensory overload, which it can be a total nightmare, but when you go back into what it really means, it, you know, your filters are damaged, everything comes in at the same value, you can't sort through the incoming data, and things go to pot. Well, the fact that everything comes in, all the data comes in at equal value, it means that I notice details that I didn't used to notice before. For instance, I'm better at reading social cues, which it, again, boosts my ability to make friends, to strengthen bonds, that kind of thing. But also just enjoying nature, things that I didn't notice before. So a lot of the losses came with gains. Task initiation isn't one. I can't think of a gain from that, but maybe if yes. I thought hard enough. I'm not a Pollyanna type person, but things happened. Good things happened.
And like you said, Deb, I think a lot of brain injury survivors, especially the further away you get from the initial injury, I believe, the more likely you are to find those silver linings, those bright spots that come with, well, the trauma that you've endured and the trauma that has changed your brain forever. Which brings me to, I guess, my biggest question, one of my last questions. Has it recurred? Have you had the angiomas come back?
I did. Okay. So angiomas can grow back. And if it's hereditary like it is with me, they can, you can get new ones. And because it's hereditary, I mean, it's basically a mutation of the normal gene. And what happened when you, but I keep losing track.
Was there a family history? Did you know of a family history?
I was the first one. And then my siblings got tested, as did my parents. My father had angiomas, but they were asymptomatic and they never bled. My two brothers didn't have them. But a couple of years later, a few years later, it was on the order of a decade later, my sister didn't want to know, basically. She just wants to live her life as if there's nothing wrong. For whatever reason, she finally went to get tested. And it turned out that she has angiomas. One of them bled. She had brain surgery. It is hereditary in our case.
Oh, wow.
But my kids didn't show signs of anything. So it would be, they'd have a 50-50 chance of having it. And they didn't go through DNA testing, which I'd like them to do. But it's also, you know, one more thing. My kids were teenagers at the time. I mean, now they're in their very early 30s. They had their lives, and I'm not going to drag them along to get the DNA tested. So.
But your sister, after, you know, saying, I don't want to know, don't want to know, she found out that she did. And then around the same time, you said that yours did recur, or yours have they caused issues since then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mine recurred in the sense of that I did have another bleed. And the trouble is when the only way to detect them definitively is through a brain MRI. And I had I go in regularly for brain MRIs. And this particular time, originally they started out, well, there's one in the parietal lobe and there's one here and one there and a cluster of them and a bunch of them over there. And it's after a while they stopped counting them. So I don't know exactly how many I have. My sister has a bunch too. And they can re-bleed. If you've had a bleed, there's the risk of another bleed from an angioma that has bled already is pretty high. But in my case, I didn't have a re-bleed. Well, because they removed them. Well, I did have a re-bleed that year, the year after the first time. But then they were removed, so they didn't bleed, but there was a new one that did bleed, but it didn't affect me. I was asymptomatic. So, but it's, you know, if I think about it, I wonder, looking back, I wonder how did I deal with all the fear? Because it's there all the time. It's like a ticking bomb. And, but you know, and then you reach a point where it's part of life. Every so often you're reminded that about unpleasant things, like, you know, you're at high risk for early onset dementia, you're at high risk for, well, in this case, another bleed and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, it can happen again. Apparently it did, but as long as it doesn't affect me, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, and living in fear, that's for, you know, the evil neurologist and her cannibal core to deal with. You know, living in fear is one of those things that you can't allow yourself to do.
Yeah.
And in the end, it seems like, you know, even at the most dire moments, you know, like you were saying, the list of things that you gained afterwards, not only a book, but also, you know, stronger bonds with friends, family, the ability to be, you know, kind of like you said, that eager extrovert, just some incredible life changes that it's not as though you told yourself, I'm going to do this. It just came with recovery.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't want to go back to the person I was before. Not that I was a terrible person, but I wasn't as comfortable in my own skin. I was empathetic to a lesser degree. I had passion in my life, but to a lesser degree. You know, you have this emotional volatility thing going on. And on the one hand, it's very unpleasant in some ways. I mean, I do suffer from severe depression, but I go, you know, I go back and forth with, obviously this is not a great brain day.
Hey, we all have those days, Deb.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
I mean, as I said, not that I was a horrible person, not that I was a lousy teacher, but everything became more in a way that I'm happy about. You know, my neuropsychologist once said to me that with brain injury, stuff that you had trouble with before now is going to be tenfold. But that's also true about the good stuff. So. The good stuff, as far as I'm concerned, the gains far outweigh the losses. No question about that. But I mean, I know a friend of mine, she's a caregiver, and actually I'm writing a book with her about the parallel journeys of brain injury survivors and their caregivers through conversations between us. That's the format, is compensate. And I think the title's going to be somewhere along the lines of surviving together, conversations between caregiver and survivor. But anyway, so while, you know, we have these conversations, and I've told her that I feel like I'm lucky for what happened. And she doesn't feel that way. And she says she hears it. She's the one who does this blog talk radio. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel the same way. She feels that things would have been better if he never had the brain injury, which is, I mean, and he has a lot of physical disabilities. I'm lucky. My physical disabilities are minimal to none. Most of mine are cognitive. I'm saying I'm lucky. Actually, it's funny because David, her husband, says that he's lucky that he didn't have any cognitive problems. That his are all physical. So we're not envious of each other.
You know, those perspectives go such a long way. I've heard that exact same phrase from a lot of folks I've talked to on the podcast and elsewhere, that feeling lucky, especially the further down the road you get, feeling lucky for whatever it is that you still have, trying not to dwell on what you lost, but, you know, what you do have, and, you know, maybe the new things that you've gained. And I think another thing that a lot of brain injury survivors also wrestle with sometimes is, you know, how much of this can I actually chalk up to my brain injury? Whether it's deficiencies or, you know, new skills, talents, interests, whatever. And I think you can drive yourself crazy. It's like, you know, I had a friend once tell me, you know, when I had an awful boss, and I was like, what is my boss even doing during the day? Like my boss is not around. This person sucks. Like they don't belong in the job. And my friend was like, you can drive yourself crazy trying to figure out what the person who makes more money than you is doing. So just don't do it. Just worry about yourself. It's the same thing with trying to figure out, you know, how you would be then or how you wouldn't be with or without brain injury. It happens. It's how it is. So just
My lousy short-term memory, in some ways I live very much in the moment. But it's also something to do with my own, with being me. When life is good, it has always been good, and it will always be good. So good brain days are forever. Bad brain days, on the other hand, I go, oh yeah, it'll pass soon. God knows why I think that way, but it, you know, it's just the way I do. So I refer to myself as the eternal optimist. I mean, that's not to say that I don't have, as I said, bad brain days or days where, yeah, I don't, you know, you people talk about the steps of grief. And at first I went through, you know, I'm going through one after the other, and I'm going, wait, I didn't have that. And I didn't have that. But ultimately, as I said, in my case, as far as I'm concerned, life is good. Yeah, I have my lousy moments, but I never felt like I didn't, I never had to spell out to myself that you need to, maybe I'll come up with it, maybe not. I never went in the dumps because of bad stuff happening. I just didn't. And I didn't, people talk about the bargaining phase. Mm. I never went through that because I'm not religious. Who would I bargain with? You know, and I never went through, oh, woe is, you know, it's not fair, why me? I didn't go through that either. Not because I'm an altruistic person. It just didn't work for me. And actually, it's nice because in terms of guilt, since the onset of the bloody brain, I don't do guilt. It just doesn't happen. Maybe a little twinge here and there, but that's about it. Hmm. Which is really nice. I mean, my parents live abroad, and they're elderly. My brother, who lives in the Boston area, he really feels guilty about not being with them. Now, my two younger siblings are right there, and they take care of them. But I don't feel guilty. I just don't. And I like that very much.
Yeah, and you know, working through all these, you know, like you said, the different stages of, you know, guilt and bargaining and everything else, it's, you know, it's something that I think I myself need to look more into, because, you know, I've never been to a psychologist. I've never seen a therapist. I've never done any of those things that I know a lot of folks with brain injuries have done, because, you know, they wanted some answers to, like, why am I thinking this way, or what am I going through? So I always tell myself, yeah, I should someday. But at the same time, I don't feel a strong need to, and mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
I needed it. I did need therapy, because I felt that it was just too big for me to deal with on my own. Mm-hmm. So I did go to therapy, and then when I finally admitted that I needed to go on meds, and I did. There was no question about it. You know, between suicide ideation and that kind of stuff. And I had a really bad bout, and that's when I went, don't want to go there again. So that's when I went to see a psychiatrist. I was worried about the meds, the, you know, antidepressants they might describe, because they might prescribe, because, you know, I was taking all this stuff, anti-seizure meds, blood pressure meds to minimize the chances of more bleeds, this kind of thing. So, you know, I was one of these people, you know, Tylenol, that's it. And I had this whole slew of medications that I take. But where did I go? This is terrible.
Oh, well, no, I definitely see it. Nervous about the interaction of...
Oh, the medication.
Yeah, the medication.
The interaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, the interaction. And my therapist sent me to a woman who was... to a psychiatrist who was also an expert with the pharmacology side of it. And it basically all I needed to do was to increase the dose, the anti-seizure meds, increase the dose of the anti-seizure meds. It didn't last. I needed to supplement it with another antidepressant. But I just had to. I would not have been able to manage. Well, I don't know if I can say that, but I probably would not have been able to manage on my own. I did come close at one point to taking action. I didn't, but, you know, I don't want to go back to that dark place. So that's the way it goes now. I don't see a therapist now. I see I don't see a psychiatrist now. I don't think I need it. I mean, my PCP prescribes the antidepressants and that stuff. So actually, come to think about it, since I moved to Boulder, I haven't seen a shrink or a therapist. So I guess Boulder is good for me.
Well, I'm happy to hear the path to recovery, not only for your brain, but also for, you know, other issues that you were seeing the therapist for. Mm-hmm. It seems like you're on the right path. And also that again, it just seems like something innate in you, like you said, you had to know more about this, which led to research, yeah. which led to a book, which led to letting family know, which then eventually led to, well, letting other folks know that have this. Yeah. To be honest, until opening your book, I never knew about cavernous angiomas. I did not know how they impacted the brain and how they worked. And yet another one of those brain terms that I was totally in the dark about.
Well, it's considered a rare disease. A lot of people have it, but they're asymptomatic. So it used to, before the advent of MRIs, the only way to diagnose them was in an autopsy. So not particularly good.
I'd prefer not to go that route to find out what I had.
Yeah,
bad in my brain.
I was hoping for another possibility. But the trouble is, because they were only diagnosable through autopsies, a lot of medical people in the medical field don't know much about it because they don't teach it. It's not it's a rare disease. And the other thing is the fact that the blood doesn't go, the rate at which it flows is relatively slow. So this woman, the evil neurologist who said that they're perfectly harmless, that's where she was coming from. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, actually, this is kind of curious. For the longest time, I think it's on Wikipedia, they had that cavernous angiomas, that the blood in them is stagnant, which they're not. And also the idea that you have stuff that shouldn't be there in your hair, in your brain, in some cases, that's going to cause a problem just by their mere existence.
I'm happy to know that, that your experience, your memoir, your zest for life now is helping people understand a little bit more about this rare disease. Maybe even the evil neurologist will open your book someday and learn something that she herself didn't know.
Oh, God, I doubt it. if you don't look into it, my neurologist, after I was diagnosed, he and his nurse practitioner went and read about it and researched it. I mean, how, to me, as a doctor, that's exactly what I would do. But, yeah. Well, I'm curious. I don't have a long nose, but I have a lot of curiosity about people, about issues, various things. And I just don't understand how you can come up with a "it's all in your head" type thing. I don't know. There's a book called Head Cases, mm-hmm, by Mason. Have you read it?
I haven't.
Yeah, he was a case manager who used to go around the country he was a case manager for, there's a tiny rehab place, brain injury rehab place, and I forget where it is, but it's supposed to be really good, but they have a very limited number of beds available. And he goes around interviewing brain injury survivors to see if how much they'll benefit from going there. But anyway, the title of his book is Head Cases. I'm
looking at it right now. Head Cases: Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath. Yeah. And Mason.
He's very good. I mean, he wrote it excellent. His writing is really good.
Great. I will definitely have to look into that because, there's something to be said about, hearing what other folks have gone to. It's like, talking about, how no two brain injuries are the same. It's true. No two brain injuries are the same. But as you start seeing them together, you see similarities between recovery and what people have been told and the medical, just the labyrinth people have to work through as they're trying to find treatment for their head injuries. Sometimes those are the unfortunate similarities, the roadblocks that people are running into. But then like yourself, finding that you're able to overcome those roadblocks through, a mix of just perseverance on your own part and also, finding what was going to work for you and eventually making that tough decision, like you said, of going to surgery, that this was what had to be done.
An interesting thing about the brain injuries being different, I mean, a lot of people, you hear it, but you don't quite internalize it. So what I say is, okay, take two identical twins, and even if they get TBI both in the same place under the same conditions, even though they're identical twins, their experiences in life are different. Maybe instead of Aunt Gugglefitch held this one, whereas Schnuggleputzi held the other one, that's a different experience, and it's going to change the brain. So you're not, every brain is different, therefore every brain injury is different. So that's another thing, is being able to explain things in a way that makes sense to people. Task initiation was a big one to explain to people, because so many, including brain injury survivors, think that it is to do with procrastination and laziness. And I'd say no, it's not the same thing. And I had to come up with something that they'd understand. And the closest I came to was, well, one is that if you're working on a very complex, involved project, and then you complete it and you need to move on to another project, it's really hard to start. So that's close to what issues task initiation is like. But if I add to that something along the lines of, well, think about it in terms of a stick shift, or it doesn't have to be a stick shift, that gets stuck randomly and you can't shift to another gear. And so you can't make that connection with a task that you need to start. There's a disconnect there. And it was funny because I explained this to my co-author about the gear shift, and she misinterpreted it. And I explained it to her, and it didn't occur to her to write about how she misinterpreted it. And I convinced her, I said, this is actually important to see for brain injury survivors, to see how the caregivers see the situation and what they understand, what they don't understand. So, yeah. So being able to explain it in a way that conveys, you need some sort of metaphor that conveys the situation. With sensory overload, it's actually, interestingly enough, that's quite easy to explain, because a lot of people have some level of it and they get it, that sometimes they feel hemmed in and sometimes they feel like there's too much noise going on. So a lot of people have it to some degree. But the issue is task initiation. Everyone thinks of it most people think of it in terms of procrastination, and that's the end of the story. But it's not. It's a completely different mechanism. So
yeah, thinking of it as as a failure of discipline, or instead of something deeper that can be overcome. Well, and it seems as though you've been able to find a way around it. You finished a book. all the way through to hybrid publish.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to, task initiation is exactly about that, starting it. It's not, once you start it, usually it works fine. But getting to that point, I mean, I've needed to read a book for my teaching, and I just couldn't do it. I tried all sorts of things. I put the book in a place where I'd see it every day, but I just couldn't start it. And then out of the blue, yes, I was able to, and I got going. And it's fairly random when it hits. So you don't have any warning, and sometimes you don't identify it as, because the thing with task initiation, you know you're going to do it. It's not like with procrastination, it's not, yes, you know that you're going to do it, but this is almost an absolute knowing. I mean, if you're procrastinating, you go, oh yeah, I should do it tomorrow, or this kind of thing. No, I want to do it now, but I can't. But I know that I can do it. It's this knowing that prevents you from realizing that this is an issue with task initiation rather than procrastination. It's an absolute truth as far as you're concerned, that it'll happen, just not right now. It took me more than a decade to get in touch with one of my cousins, whom I used to be really close to. I just couldn't get in touch with him, and finally I did. And we're not as close as we used to be, because I assume, because in his mind, you know, I wasn't interested in hanging out with him or whatever. And as I said, sometimes it never happens. You can never start. Other times, just out of the blue, okay, yeah, I'll do it. It's really, really, it's very odd. And my neuropsychologist came up with told me what to do. He said, okay, once you identify a task that you're having trouble with, put it on a daily to-do list, a daily task list. It's not the same as to-do list because to-do lists tend to be too long. But so you need to put in no more than two tasks on your list. And if you put in more, then it's going to be too much and you're not going to do anything. And he's right, because I poo-pooed his advice and put three things on my list. And I didn't do any of them.
Even the one was enough to break the list.
What?
Even the one extra task was enough to break the list.
Yes. Because, you know, you get overwhelmed really easily. A lot of people do. A lot of survivors do. So I learned that. But there's one problem there, and that's initiating the task of writing down the to-do list. It's a no-win situation. And plus, add to that lousy memory. And also, sometimes you have a lot of trouble identifying the problematic task because you're going to do it, just not now. But it's as though, you're standing, you have to go across a river to do something, and you have no way of doing it. You don't have that connection. There's no bridge. There's no, ferry. You just can't physically... It's almost a physiological thing. You just can't make that leap to starting the task. And then out of the blue, suddenly you can or not. It's such a bizarre one.
It is. And I found one that helps me is specifically with writing. I like to do creative writing on the side, but I also have a hard time getting into it because I'm like, man, I've got this to do, this to do, this to do, this to do. And by the time I get around to it, it's 10:30 at night and I got to be to work at 5:30 the next morning and I'm already drained. And I'm like, my returns will be diminished. So what I've found helps is setting aside specifically just 30 minutes in the day, 30 minutes in the day. Like, when I know that I got some time and not when I know I got time, but when I can make some time. And it's like if you've ever heard NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month, that is a great incentive for anybody who struggled to write, because your only task for an entire month is just write 2,000 words a day.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do.
This is what my neuropsychologist said. Okay, you do your task list for the day, and then you block off chunks of time to do them during that day. And it works like a charm as long as everything else works fine,
Yes. Yeah. And I found that, time, especially, through most of my life, has been my enemy. I was the kid that was always running late. I was the kid that was always, perpetually, not 15, 20 minutes late, but 2 or 5 minutes late. Just always. Just could not figure it out. And so, I found that if I even set just 30 minutes aside and I tell myself 30 minutes, that is one stupid cartoon. It's not that much time. 30 minutes is not that much time. So just set aside 30 minutes to write. And if you write 20 words, great. If you write 2,000 words, great. But the point is just to sit down and write.
The ability to do that is not, and then you get tired. And, you go through the stuff and then it's evening and you're tired, too tired to do it, to take those 30 minutes. And then what? Well, postpone it for the next day. But, there is a feedback thing going on there with task initiation. There was one time I was, I also had a bit of an OCD thing going on. So I had my chunk of time. And that's also from the brain injury. Never had a problem with that before. And it's not major at all. Mm-hmm. Just the idea this is terrible. Losing my train of thought. I'm not that bad normally. I didn't sleep well, which is probably why. What was I saying? Do you remember?
But yeah, with task initiation, like you said, oh, you had like a little bit of an OCD that came afterwards. And
oh, yeah, that if I have it written down somewhere that this is what I'm going to do, I have to do that. So one day I had two tasks set up. I finished the one. And then it came time to do the other, and I just couldn't. I was too tired. And I'm lying in bed and telling myself, you have to do this. It's on your list. You have to do it. And then I had this epiphany just as I'm falling asleep. Oh, you can just put on the next day's task. And when I told my neuropsychologist about it, oh, he said, yeah, I forgot to tell you about that. Oh, thanks.
Well, glad I figured it out on my own.
Yeah, which is, you know, you just feel like such an idiot sometimes. But, you know, I mean, this is another thing. As you well know, humor is one of the best things you can do when you're going through a horrible situation. And especially if you have a morbid sense of humor. And yeah, morbid, I'll go for it. I'm good with that.
It really does help. I mean, humor, it helps to be able to laugh at yourself, you know, like laugh at yourself, laugh at the situation. And I think most people understand, at least the people that you want to be around, most people understand, oh, it's okay. You know, like when I space people's names, I have a hard time. Proper nouns are my nemesis. And remembering names, especially if I've met you 4 or 5 times, even in person, shook your hand, I probably won't remember your name. So I just say, hey, it's going to take me 2 more times because that's how many more times I've hit my head in my life. And people kind of like give me like, you know, crook their head like, what? And I'm like, oh, I've nailed my head a bunch. What's your name again? You got to remind me. And just kind of laugh at it. Laugh it off. And people tend to laugh it off with you.
Yeah. I mean, when I've missed meetings and things like that because of no organizational skills, poor memory, all that kind of stuff. And all I can say is, oops, I can't do more than that. It happened. If I'm lucky, you can reschedule it. But ultimately, oops, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I had this was the few days after my third surgery, came back home, went over to the neighbors. And we were, you know, she had a friend over and we're sitting at the dining room table and chatting. And the neighbor says, oh, I saw this movie recently. It just came out. And the other woman goes, oh, I know. I bet I know which one it is. It's the one, you know, with the actor. So I have no idea what they're trying to talk about. But, you know, I want to join in the conversation. And I just got back and was sitting with my kids to watch a video. Not that I only managed half an hour of it, if that. And so I want to join the conversation. So I said, oh, I don't know which movie you're talking about, but I just saw this great movie on a video, a brand new, just came out. It's the one with the actor with, you know, with the hair. And at that point, we all three of us just lose it. So my next door neighbor had chemo brain. Her friend was going through menopause, and there was I, and we were just laughing. And her husband comes up from the basement, and he says, "What's so funny?" And we just kept laughing. It's just so it's a lot of it is really funny, especially issues with my memory. I speak to my writing coach once a week, and she'll say, "So, how was your week?" And I'll say, doing my usual, everything's great now, therefore it's always going to be great, or always has been great. I'll tell her, oh, yeah, it's been great. And she'll say, but didn't you have this happen? And I'm going, really? Tell me more about it.
Remind
me. Tell me more. Yeah. And then she goes, then I go, oh, that's been horrible. As far as I'm concerned, you know, she's telling a story about a stranger, you know. But I mean, it's reached a point where we just both laugh when she asks the question, and I'll say, "Oh, I'm sure it was good. Hasn't it been good?"
Well, Deb, I'm happy to report I've had those moments as well. So as long as we can all laugh about it, and yeah, that's you know, it's what I have to like remind myself, and also you know, people that are close to me. You know, it's not out of spite. I don't forget things because I dislike them or dislike you or don't want to remember it. I just simply cannot. And one last time, remind folks the name of your book and where they can find it.
But My Brain Had Other Ideas, a memoir of recovery from brain injury. And you can find it anywhere. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. If you want independent bookstores, you can order it through them. So, and I have copies.
Copies through your website?
No, actually, the website takes you to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and some independent bookstores.
Okay, but if you want to find it, it's again debbrandon.com?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, Deb, thanks again for making time to be here on the podcast. Been great talking to you, great hearing about your story, and best of luck with, well, whatever comes next. Can't wait to read the next book.
Thanks. Well, thanks a lot. It was great talking to you, too.
Good to be out here on TBI, Talking Brain Injury Podcast from Brain Injury Alliance, Colorado.